Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
Anyone in the military that thinks they don't have rights, they need to call the GI Rights Hotline, or they need to call the Military Law Task Force. They need to talk to these people and learn specifically what their rights are, because you do have rights.
We continue our conversation with award-winning journalist Dar Jamail, author of the 2009 book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Dar Jamail is author of the 2008 book, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. He covered Iraq as an unembedded journalist starting out in 2003.
You know, we're looking at in excess now of 1.4 million Iraqis have died as a direct result of the invasion and occupation.
Dar Jamail's 2009 book exposes the other big story about Iraq and Afghanistan. It, too, has been little covered by major media in America. The book, The Will to Resist, reveals the scale of the crisis for U.S. servicemen and women who must fight in these unpopular wars, but who are exhausted, angry about the policies, or even wounded from their previous deployments. There is no draft to force them, yet thousands of U.S. military personnel are being forced to deploy and redeploy. Dar Jamail tells their story. Last time, we heard Dar Jamail explain how he and other war correspondents cope with covering the Iraq War and how he found common ground with soldiers.
There's a lot of people that go to Iraq, for example, and never leave the green zone, literally. Journalists and soldiers and contractors alike that literally will go over there and spend a year there and never leave, and I've talked to these people. So I'm not talking about those people, although they'll certainly have maybe some things to work out when they come home too. But those of us who actually go out there and, you know, see the violence and experience it firsthand and see how it's affecting people around us, that it's impossible to not come back home unscathed. And so when you're in that kind of environment, in any kind of war, you basically have to start putting on psychological armor to protect yourself, and spiritual armor for that matter, that it's such a horrible situation that you can't walk into it completely open, or you would just be completely devastated internally by it. And this is my personal experience. And because I did walk into it completely open, that way back when we first started back in talking back in December 2003, and you know, it affected me deeply. And you know, but then when you stay in that environment, you have to start taking care of yourself, and that means you basically have to start shutting down certain parts of yourself. Like you can't allow yourself to experience all of this stuff completely acutely on a daily basis, or I think you'd probably go mad. And so you start kind of closing off a bit and becoming a bit hardened and kind of stuffing a lot of feelings and such. But the problem, and that works, that takes care of you, and journalists and soldiers do it alike. But the problem is, over time, it gets to where you really can't feel anything. And by the time I got back from Iraq, and this is how I really bonded and I think won the trust and respect and comradeship with a lot of the soldiers I interviewed in The Will to Resist, was that you come back home and basically all you can feel is rage. You can't feel anything else because you come back out of this horrible situation and you come back to the United States where it's like Disneyland by comparison, where so many people here walking around just unawares that these wars are even happening and certainly not making any kind of sacrifices in their lives to try to end them. And you walk around in this environment, you know, like maybe you've been in Baghdad a week earlier, as was the case with me, like walking through morgues looking at body parts laying on gurneys that your tax dollars funded. And then you come back here and people's biggest concern is like, what do they want to get on their pizza that night? Or where's my next vacation going to be? And, you know, that's a little upsetting. And that causes this huge disparity. There's this huge gap then that you really can't cross. And so you feel really isolated. And you really can't relate to these people back here, even though you were really close to them before you went overseas. And then now, what becomes more normal is Iraq and Afghanistan, because that's real and that's what's happening. And over here, it's Disneyland, and this is fake. This isn't, you know, this isn't what most people are having to live with. And so it's a really kind of crazy-making situation, and we all need to get help with that. We all need to talk to a counselor. We all need to take care of ourselves and learn how to live with that disparity and kind of work these things out, and even more, like, you know, talk about and work through the things that we saw over there that caused the trauma in the first place. But then, you know, then to talk about what does that say about our society here, you know, where here we are living in the belly of the beast, so to speak, living in the empire, where here is the genesis of this military that's been going around occupying these countries and generating so much death and strife and suffering. And roughly 50% of all of our tax dollars are going to fund the military in some way, shape, or form. And so, you know, what does that do to us spiritually to live in a society where, you know, we all intrinsically know this stuff, whether people want to try to ignore it and act like it's not happening or not. Like, we all intrinsically know that we're living in a very privileged place and that it's costing the rest of the world a lot for us to get to live this way. And so I think the kind of a bigger existential question is then, what does that do to us? You know, what does that do to us as a society and a culture and a country to live with this disparity that keeps getting more wide?
Dar, when you speak to GIs, I'm reminded of some of what you were writing about Iraqis when I read what you've written about U.S. GIs, because you're describing a three-dimensional human being, not just a news situation. You really are interested in people quite clearly. And I've wondered, you know, do some of these soldiers cry? I know you've written about the Iraqis that you were interviewing just breaking down and weeping at times when you did interview them. How do these soldiers come across? Are they vulnerable? Are they allowing themselves to be vulnerable?
Well, I think just by talking to the press about their situation, they're allowing themselves to be vulnerable. And I think this in itself is a radical act because, you know, they're coming out of a military that basically tells them that, look, when you sign the dotted line, you have no rights. We own you, and you can't question anything, and you're just to do what you're told, and you're not supposed to think about anything. You're supposed to just follow orders and be a good soldier. And in reality is that that even goes against what the Uniform Code of Military Justice tells soldiers to do, which is the law they have to abide by as a soldier, which says, you know, A, they're not ever supposed to follow an illegal order. They are allowed to petition a commander. They are allowed to petition Congress. They are allowed to have a civilian attorney. They are allowed to file for conscientious objector status if they realize that's what they need to do. I mean, they do have a lot of rights, and so that means they have to think for themselves, which of course runs contrary to what the military wants them to think, because they just want robots. So when these men and women come out and talk to me or any other journalist or someone on the radio about their experience, that's a radical act for them. That's a really, really big step when we appreciate that they came out of this context of such a repressive military environment. And when they've done that, my experience with them is that, you know, I have talked to people that have been, you know, when they start talking, and a lot of the time they'll say things like, I've never told this to anybody before, or they will cry, or they will share with you things that they've been keeping to themselves for a long, long time. So it's a really profound experience for them, and to me, I really have utmost respect for these people in the military, both active duty and people who have been discharged, who are coming out and talking about, look, this was my experience, this is what they taught us in boot camp, this is what I did when I was over there, and I'm coming back, and I'm talking to you now because I believe it's wrong. And it's really, really profound. And then to take it the next step, some of these folks that I've been talking with recently, some of these Afghanistan war resistors, people like Victor Augusto and Travis Bishop, who are very clearly articulating things like the UN Charter and international law and the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution that says we have to abide by that, and the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and getting very, very clear about the fact that not only Iraq, but the occupation of Afghanistan is in violation of international and domestic law as well, and therefore as a soldier, since I swore to uphold and defend the Constitution, I can't follow that order because that's an illegal order.
Interesting, isn't it, that Lieutenant William Calley, people may remember him from the Vietnam era as having participated in the My Lai massacre, where more than 500 peasants shot at point-blank range, villages burned, My Lai it was. He has come out and said recently that he's sorry for what he did and also that he was under orders. An interesting comment, I think, especially coming as it does in this climate, right?
It really is. And again, I applaud that action. I mean, that takes a lot of courage and a lot of integrity, even albeit being quite late. Absolutely better late than never. And I think it's a wonderful thing that he did that, especially in this context when, you know, we're looking at in excess now of 1.4 million Iraqis have died as a direct result of the invasion and occupation. And in Afghanistan, we don't even have a number. We know it's tens of thousands. We know it's well over 20,000, which is an enormous amount of civilians to die. I mean, how would that be reported in the media here if something had happened, even though it stretched across years, that caused 20,000 Americans to die? You know, there'd be a lot of outcry about that, I would hope. But we look at that kind of thing and these soldiers coming back. And again, we have modern iterations of this gentleman where people are coming out and saying, look, I mean, I've talked to these people directly and they've told me to my face, I was in Fallujah and I killed people. You know, my job was to be a sniper and I just shot anything that moved. And the thing is, we can't really have change unless we know that there's a problem. You know, if there's a huge problem, until you actually admit it, there's really nothing you can do about it because you're in denial of that problem. And to say we have a problem in this country is being really silly. I mean, we've got a huge crisis that's ripped this country to pieces and is going to continue to do so. And yet here are these truth tellers that are coming back and saying, they're pointing directly at the problem and their part in it and saying, look, this is what happened and this has to change. And I think that's absolutely critical. So then the onus is on us as citizens in this country, as journalists, and I think above all as human beings. Like, look, this is wrong and this has to stop, and I have to take responsibility to do whatever is necessary to make that happen.
Dar Jamil, you've mentioned a sergeant with strong religious beliefs. He came to the conclusion that he had to be given conscientious objector status, CO status. That's where a soldier declares he is unable to take up arms against a fellow human being in war. There is alternative service for people like that. But tell us this man's story and just talk about how he's made out with his efforts.
Travis Bishop, he's a sergeant in the U.S. Army, and he served a tour over in Iraq for 13 months. And then he came back to Fort Hood, Texas, where he was stationed, and was then told, you have to start getting ready to go to Afghanistan. And he had been in the middle of a process of really deepening his faith and reading the Bible. And he said, particularly as I got those orders to go to Afghanistan, you know, I realized I need to get right with my Creator. Because, you know, like anyone else cognizant today, he said, look, you know, this is a very bad situation. I'm going over there as a soldier. There's a really high likelihood that I'm going to get into some kind of combat. And so he basically started praying a lot and reading his Bible and learning, getting more into his faith. And he said as he read his Bible that he realized that if he's going to be a real Christian, you know, where Jesus told him to turn the other cheek, he said, I have to be opposed to all war because that's what real Christianity is. So he realized he needed to file for conscientious objector status. His unit was about to deploy, and so in order to file for conscientious objector status in the military requires a lot of paperwork. You have to write a long essay explaining why you're doing this, because basically you have to prove your moral convictions that show that you're opposed to all violence of any kind, no matter what. So he went AWOL for a week to get his paperwork in order, and then came back into base and turned himself in and said, look, here I am. I never intended to stay away. I didn't have enough time to get this done. I'm not going to deploy to Afghanistan because it's against my morals, and here's my conscientious objector paperwork. And so, of course, they court-martial him, as they do anyone that disobeys a direct order. And it was basically a kangaroo court. I actually happened to be in Houston around the time of his court-martial, so I drove up to Fort Hood and went to his court-martial, and what an amazing experience, because, you know, it's one thing to hear about rigged trials and kangaroo courts, and considering the fact that well over 90% of all military court-martials result in a conviction. You know, to go to this court where there's a military judge, there's a military jury of high-ranking people in the military, lifers. So it's kind of like the Lord judging the peasant, because then you have Sergeant Travis Bishop sitting there trying to defend why he filed for conscientious objector status and why he disobeyed this order to go to Afghanistan. And it was a total farce. I mean, we all knew going into it, he's going to jail. And that's exactly what happened. I sat behind him, and he stuck to his guns, but he, you know, ended up, they threw the book at him. They gave him a year in jail, a year in a military brig. They reduced his rank back down to private. He forfeits two-thirds of all his pay while he's in jail. And then when he gets out, he's going to get an unlawful discharge. And so he has stuck to his convictions, though. And, you know, I talked to him right before they shackled him up, hands and feet, and took him out to a van to take him to jail right after the trial. And I said, look, this is, and he was struggling. I mean, he openly admitted to me, he's like, yeah, I've cried, I'm scared, this is hard, I don't want to go to jail for a year, I don't know what's going to happen. But he said, you know what, I'm going to be able to sleep with myself at night because I'm following my conscience. And when I get out, I'm going to be free. And, you know, that was a similar thing that I've heard from Camilo Mejia, the first conscientious objector to this war who also did 9 months in jail. That's exactly what I heard from Victor Augusto, also from Fort Hood, who was court-martialed a week before Travis Bishop, who's also sitting in jail right now. He said, look, this is the right thing to do. And if society's punishing me for doing the right thing, then the onus is on them, not me.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. We're syndicated with Pacifica Network. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com if you're interested in having your favorite radio station air our program. If you are a soldier listening to this broadcast, or if you know one, the GI Rights hotline number is 877-447-4487. You can find information about GI Rights, counseling, military discharges, and AWOL status. The web URL is girightshotline.org. You can also try the Center on Conscience and War at centeronconscienceandwar.org. The Military Law Task Force is a project of the National Lawyers Guild. You can contact them at 619-463-2368 or search Military Law Task Force online. Dar, I want to talk a little bit about blame. In Beyond the Green Zone, you talk about your translator, Harb, and you explain a scene where he was phoning you on a cell phone while he was under U.S. capture and in a mosque, and he was describing a horrific scene where people praying in a mosque were being shot by U.S. soldiers. A heartrending and deeply disturbing exchange you had with him on the phone, Dar. What goes through your mind? I mean, do you feel at times compelled to share that kind of work with some of these soldiers like Travis? I mean, this was a mosque. This was their faith, their God, that they were trying to speak to in the middle of a war, and they were being killed. How do you deal with this?
It's funny because the joke's kind of on me, because when I was working on Beyond the Green Zone and talking with you so often from Baghdad and reporting really just on the Iraqi perspective, I mean, I hated soldiers. I hated the military. I hated them for what they were doing. I hated them for the destruction and suffering they were causing over there. I did, you know, and now having really talked with these soldiers and understand that in the broader context, they're victims of this system too. And yes, they absolutely do not have it as bad as the Iraqis. There's no question about that. And they're not suffering as much as the Iraqis. There's no question about that. But they, in the broader context, you know, having been put in these positions and gone over there, they're going up against a military that sent 43,000 troops already diagnosed with traumatic brain injury, sent them back into combat. They're going up against a military that, when someone goes to their doctor in Iraq, their army doctor, and says, look, I have post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm having nightmares. I can't sleep. I'm throwing up my food. I can't operate. I need help. I need treatment. They'll give them sleeping drugs and send them back into combat. They've done that with over 40,000 soldiers. They're going up against a military that, of all the soldiers coming back home from Iraq and Afghanistan, one out of every five has traumatic brain injury. We're talking about well over 200,000 people. We're talking about well over 300,000 people from both occupations that have severe post-traumatic stress disorder and severe depression. You know, this is a military that they don't care any more about the soldier than they do about the Iraqi or the person in Afghanistan. So these people know, like, look, I'm going up against this machine, you know, as the Army's referred to as the big green machine, and it really could care less about me. And so what does that mean? But I have been in a position where I've talked to these folks, and I don't really get specific with them about stories like that because they're really, really fragile when they first start talking about this stuff. And it's the rare person like Camilo Mejia and just a few other people who have worked through enough of their own stuff that they actually can and will talk about stuff. You know, Camila will come out and say, like, yeah, I killed people, and just talk about it matter-of-factly, but of course understanding the full implications of what that means. But most of these other people, I don't get real specific with them. I'll just say, like I told Travis when he was about to get on this damn van to take him to jail for a year of his life, I said, look, you know, you're saving lives. You know, you're saving your own, and you're definitely saving other people's lives. And absolutely, you're doing the right thing. You know, I've been over there, and I've seen it, and I can tell you that. Don't ever question that.
Dar Jamil, I can remember you're telling me how U.S. soldiers were walking the streets of Iraq with their arms twitching and shaking and visibly emotionally distressed and trigger happy. You were afraid of those soldiers, weren't you?
Absolutely, all of us were, because, you know, here's this person, this very well-armed person walking around among a civilian population and clearly disturbed. I mean, clearly not in their right mind. And so what do you do with that? I mean, yeah, that's absolutely something that's a very disconcerting thing to witness. You know, here's this guy walking around behaving that way with a very large automatic weapon. And then around him are several other people in the same position. And then nearby are their vehicles with even bigger weapons on them. So if any little thing goes off in that situation and you're standing there as a civilian, then you know, like, we're dead. I mean, they're going to just kill all of us. You know, and then especially now, after coming back and interviewing these soldiers firsthand, who said, yeah, we were completely stressed out, and we were afraid, and we decided we were going to do whatever was necessary to stay alive, even if that meant shooting anything that moved or running other cars off the road or whatever. But yeah, I think that's kind of the core of what we're talking about on this topic of, again, these soldiers are put in this really totally untenable situation. They're asked to do something that they know morally is wrong, and they know ethically it's wrong, and they know legally it's wrong. And then they have to walk around and still go try to do their job anyway. And the end result is that, you know, that story is not going to end well.
It seems to me that these soldiers are intensely suffering when they arrive at home. And for any of them to receive punishment for then speaking out in any way about anything, it seems to me that this runs contrary to the higher goal of American free speech or democracy.
Absolutely it does. And the thing is that legally they still do have free speech. Not as much as us. I mean, that's one thing we have to be clear about, that in the military, you know, they do have more restrictions. But ultimately, when they come back, and especially once they're discharged, is they absolutely can do and say whatever they want. It is funny. I mean, I've also talked to people who have been threatened by the military for speaking out, even some folks who've received threats after they were discharged. They have to educate themselves and understand, like, what is legal and what's not. And then, you know, those, like Liam Madden in Boston, was a good example of this, where he was going to protest wearing uniform, wearing camouflage, etc., and then started getting threats from the military, and he stood up to them, basically said, no, look, I'm totally within my rights, you can't do this. And, you know, they kept making their threats, and he ended up getting on lots of national media, basically making the military look like total idiots, because they were the ones that were out of line, and they were the ones that were basically just trying to use brute force to get him to do what they wanted him to do, when in reality there was no legal basis for their argument whatsoever. And, you know, this really underscores that, like, anyone in the military that thinks they don't have rights, they need to call the GI Rights Hotline, or they need to call the Military Law Task Force. They need to talk to these people and learn specifically what their rights are, because you do have rights. And if you decide you want to stand up and resist these occupations because they both violate international law and domestic law because of the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, that you can get a lawyer and you can stand up and you can start taking action to not go follow these orders, which basically, at the end of the day, are going to make you a party to war crimes.
Dar Jamil, finally, should a member of U.S. Congress put forth a bill that would make it illegal to punish a soldier by taking away his or her benefits?
Absolutely, because when someone comes up and signs a contract in good faith, any contract, whether it's a soldier with the military or any of us with any other contract, I mean, we expect that contract to be honored. That's why you sign your name there, and that's why the other person signs. So therefore, here's this legal document binding this contract. That means I have to do what I agree to in this, and you have to agree to do what you agreed to do. And the thing is, the soldiers are fulfilling their agreement. The military and the government are not. So legal recourse has to be taken. When a soldier signs up for a four-year contract like Victor Augusto and then comes back home, serves a tour, does nothing but a good job throughout his time in the Army, and then they tell him about a month before his contract, oh, sorry, we're going to send you to Afghanistan for a year. That's not right. That's, you know, despite the fact that there's stop loss, despite the fact that there's a giant individual ready reserve recall, we're talking about contracts being broken and people's trust being betrayed. And I think soldiers, absolutely Congress needs to support doing the right thing. And soldiers who sign a contract, like, they have to have those contracts honored. And if the military breaks their agreement and then the soldier decides to stand up against them, they need to be protected and their rights need to be protected and their benefits and the things that were promised to them, all that needs to be protected.
There's a selfish reason for legislating against this kind of punitive measure on the part of the military, which is that, you know, as in Iraq, when the U.S. military began heavy-handed tactics against Iraqis, they reached a break point. They just felt like they had nothing more to lose. They joined the resistance. And I think, you know, the suicide rate alone is telling us that these members of the U.S. force have reached a limit that they cannot go beyond. And I think to ask them to do so is to invite disaster, either for them personally and their families, or for the force, or for all of American society, in fact.
Exactly. You know, and this brings us really around full circle to what we were talking about earlier, is that asking these people to continue on what they're doing, you know, following illegal orders, illegally occupying countries halfway around the world, killing people, having themselves killed, putting everything on the line so that corporate interests can make more profits than ever, and the U.S. Empire Project can continue to try to expand, even though we're really in the twilight of empire at this point. And that's just simply so wrong and so illegal. And then what is that doing to the country internally? And, you know, I think really it underscores the courage and integrity of these people in the military who've really quite literally lived through, gone through the belly of the beast and then stand up and kind of wipe themselves off and say, look, this is all wrong and I participated in it and I'm not going to participate in it anymore and I'm going to resist it. And it's really therefore up to all of us to do whatever we can to, you know, like as a journalist in my case, get their information out as quickly as and as effectively as possible so that other people can understand what's happening. And then I think it's the responsibility of people who take in that information. What are they going to do about it? You know, are they going to find some of these people, see if they can help them? Are they going to call the GI Rights Hotline and ask what they can do to help or support groups like Iraq Veterans Against the War? Are they going to get involved in something else to start working to end these occupations? Because if they're not, I think they need to ask themselves, why not? Why do I think I get a free pass? Why do I think I get to just like live here and not do anything when all this is going on? I think these are really important questions.
Dar, thank you so much again, and we are looking forward to seeing you for the 19th, 20th, and 21st of September in Connecticut.
I'm looking forward to it as well, Dorian. Thank you very much again.
You can find out more about Dar Jamail and his books and articles online at dar.org, D-A-H-R. He currently writes for Interpress Service, Le Monde Diplomatique, and other publications, and his stories have been published with many outlets, including The Nation, The Sunday Herald in Scotland, Al Jazeera, The Guardian, Foreign Policy in Focus, that's FPIF.org, as well as The Independent. Dar Jamail is currently on a U.S. book tour for his 2009 book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Dar Jamail will visit Connecticut September 19th, 20th, and 21st for talks at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, at Eastern Connecticut State University in Willimantic, Central Connecticut State University in New Britain, and Wesleyan University in Middletown, where he will share the stage with singer-songwriter David Rovix. Dar Jamail will also speak at the Wrench in the Works Collective in Willimantic and at the Hope Out Loud Festival in Bushnell Park. willtoresistwar.blogspot.com for more information. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. You can write to us at TalkNationRadio@gmail.com.